Well, you've been following the news and the events that are going on on the world scene. We're living in a time that is very interesting in terms of what is shaping up on the world scene. And some of the most significant things are the things that will result or be sort of the spinoff of the things that are taking place. Of course, what is happening in the Middle East, what is happening in Iraq, or concerning Iraq, is sort of front and center in terms of the news. Of course, you heard the good news. Saddam Hussein finally found the weapons that he didn't think he had. He says, well, he'll destroy three or four of them. I think they only had 100, and so he'll get rid of a few of them. And he's right on schedule. Heard that. A lot of things are sort of bubbling and boiling in the Middle East. I think it is important to sometimes step back a little bit and realize what started the present chain of events that ultimately, it appears, are going to erupt in war in the Middle East and involving Iraq. You know, what's happening over there right now is not simply, it didn't all just start with 9/11. Reality is that it started a year earlier. The event that was the first in this particular chain of events started on the evening of the Feast of Trumpets in the year 2000, on the evening of the Feast of Trumpets on top of the Temple Mount. Remember, Ariel Sharon, escorted by about 400 policemen, made his way from the Wailing Wall to the top of the Temple Mount to assert the right of Jews to re-enter the old area of the temple and to pray on the Temple Mount. Well, you know, he said all he'd come for was to pray, but he brought 400 policemen and soldiers with him, which was sort of an indication that he figured somebody might object, which they did, but their objection was not particularly relevant at the time because he went up there. But the result in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath, was the launching of what the Arabs call their intifada, and all of these terrorist and suicide bombings, all of it began in the result of that day. Of course, in the months that followed, Sharon got elected Prime Minister of Israel. About a year after that, was the attack on the Twin Towers in New York. The launching of the war on terrorism and what's going on right now in the Middle East is very much part of that. You remember when President Bush gave his speech on terrorism, he said there was an axis of evil in the world, and he linked Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. You see the events that are transpiring. One of the things that most of those who comment on the news and those who write the columns and talk about world events, you see, because they don't understand Bible prophecy, they don't understand the full significance of a lot of the things that are happening. And one of the things that has not really dawned on them is the real significance of what is happening in Europe. Because there is very definitely an alliance that is emerging in Europe consisting of Germany, France, and Russia on the one side, opposed to the United States and Britain on the other. Now, it's very interesting because Germany right now is playing, they're sort of sitting in the background. They've pushed France forward. Here, you do the talking. We'll just sort of stand here and support you. And France has been happy to do the talking. They like to do the talking. They have really been making a lot of noise. But Germany is the real power behind it, and they have emboldened Mr. Chirac. Now Russia has come out and said, well, you know, they might just veto the resolution. This has created quite a stir. Now, it should not be a surprise, you know, in the aftermath of World War II, of course, Germany and France sought to form an alliance. Konrad Adenauer from Germany and Charles de Gaulle from France sought to form an alliance that they said will preserve the peace in Europe, because going back to the 1800s, back in the 1870s, the Franco-Prussian War, Germany and France. World War I, right there with Germany and France. World War II, Germany and France. That conflict, that trouble was right at the heart and core of what had plunged Europe into World War I and World War II, and there had been a warfare between the French and the Germans the generation previously in the 1870s. And so Adenauer and de Gaulle were going to form an alliance that was going to be the key component of a new Europe around which everything else would form. Now, you know the trouble that people have, and the trouble that a lot of the commentators and the opinion writers of opinion pieces in the newspapers and the magazines, most of them simply are able to look at what is going on the world scene right now, and then they try to project out present trends. But you see, you can't arrive at the accurate answer just by projecting out the present trends. What if you had been an observer in Germany in the late 1920s? What were the trends? Well, you had the Weimar Republic. Germany was in a terrible state in terms of its economy. Inflation was sky high. The people were demoralized. They were not a force to be reckoned with from either a political or a military standpoint. They were under a heavy burden of reparations that were supposed to be paid for to the winners of World War I. There were a lot of different things. If you would have looked and projected present trends, which of course is what a lot of folks did, you'd have said, well, you know, one thing about it, we know Germany's out of the counting. They're out of the picture. They're not going to play a major role. Why? Their economy is in such a mess, and they've got hyperinflation. The people are demoralized. They'll never amount to anything again, not in our lifetime. Well, those who projected that were very much seriously mistaken. Because by 1933, a man by the name of Adolf Hitler had been elected to the chancellorship of Germany. And within 6 years after that, the world was in the beginnings of World War II. You see, present trends can undergo a very abrupt change when the man and the moment meet. You can have circumstances and situations on the world scene that are going a particular way, that set a particular stage, but there comes a time in the crucial junctures in world history when the man and the moment have met, and things, instead of just continuing a trend, have made a very abrupt turn. That's the problem, of course, that many of the commentators have, because they look at what's going on and they try to project out the trends. They look at some of these things and they discount, as of course in the aftermath of World War II, Germany going to play a major role? Why, Germany was divided up into four occupation zones. The Russians had clamped their boot on the eastern part. Western Germany was divided up between a French, British, and American occupation zone. Germany was bombed out. The cities were destroyed. The factories were destroyed. What could Germany do? Well, you know, a few years later, the Western occupation zones had united as the nation of West Germany. But those who looked at events on the world scene, and those who were the commentators on world events and the writers of opinion pieces and news analysis, they said, well, you know, one thing we can count on, Germany's never going to get reunited, because the Russians will never allow that. Germany won't be able to emerge as some major player on the world scene. The Russians would never allow such a thing. That seemed to make sense. In fact, most of us, as we looked at it, had trouble imagining a scenario where what did happen would happen. And you see, the trouble we get into, and the trouble that we can fall into, the problem that the worldly analysts have, is they're just looking at present trends. They can look at history, and they can look at present trends, and they try to project out present trends. Well, present trends can make very abrupt turns, as history certainly shows us. The problem sometimes that we can run into, the Bible gives us a picture of the way things will look at the end. You and I look, on the one hand, at the picture the Bible draws of the way things will be. We look at where things are today, and we try to figure out how they're going to get from here to there. And so people come up with their guesses and their scenarios, and maybe this will happen or that will happen. And, you know, we've all found, I think, generally, that the way things come about, you never really guess the way, the details of how it's going to happen. There are a lot of things that you and I can look at, prophecies that we've been familiar with for years or for decades. You know, I think of the one very classic example even concerning the church. How many times have we over the years read the prophecies about that day shall not come except there first come a falling away? Well, did you ever imagine that it would happen the way it did? Did you have all the details figured out? We all knew that that's what it said. And yet, when events started happening, sometimes, as you're in the midst of it, takes a little while to figure out what is the significance of what's happening around you. We look on the world scene, we look at the events. The Bible talks about the role that Assyria will play, talks about the role of what is today, what is modern Germany. We look at the prophecies in Scripture. And for years, as we found ourselves in the 50s and 60s and 70s, trying to imagine how such a thing could actually happen. Yet, when God's time came, the man and the moment met. Events came together in a certain way. And I think that's what we have to realize as we look at the situation now. And I think it's sort of futile to try to project out every detail and guess exactly what all things are going to happen. But I do think that it is very interesting and very significant that on the one hand, you have a clear cleavage in terms of what is going on the world scene with the nations of France and Germany and Russia. And I think we're going to see a growing alliance there. You know, a couple of things we can draw. One of the things, if you go back to the book of Genesis, when Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery, they were motivated by envy, by jealousy. I don't think we should discount the fact that events that happened to the latter day Joseph may very well involve some of his brothers being motivated by envy and by jealousy. We know the beast power is going to emerge. We read about the 10 toes. We recognize and have for decades that, you know, the 2 legs in the image of Daniel represented the Eastern Roman Empire and the Western Roman Empire. The toes represent an alliance that puts back together the remnants of both Rome and Byzantium, the Eastern Roman Empire and the Western Roman Empire. You know, Germany is pushing France to the forefront, letting them take sort of center stage. But when all is said and done, ultimately, it's going to be Germany that's really playing the major role. We're going to see this alliance that is right now just sort of in its infancy and sort of throwing its weight around a little bit. We're going to see, of course, growing resentment and a growing rift between continental Europe and the Americans and British, on the other hand. Now, we look at some of these things. We look at things that are happening on the world scene now. We realize that what is happening is certainly going to have major implications in several areas. It's going to have major implications in the American economy. It's going to have major implications in terms of the Middle East. It's going to have major implications in terms of what is occurring on the world scene in terms of Europe and America and the alliance that took place in the aftermath of World War II. There is a passing, and there has been for a period of time, we've talked about that, a passing of the post-World War II era. And that order of things, the post-World War II order of things, began collapsing in Europe when the Iron Curtain came down, the Berlin Wall fell, and there has not yet emerged its replacement. We know what ultimately will emerge. The thing we watch to see is the details of how. But that's not really the primary question I want to focus our attention on today, the how, because you and I can't really answer all the details of that. We can speculate and guess and look at certain things. But the real question that we need to be understand more clearly is not simply the how. We know the what. We know what's going to emerge. We will have to watch and see how the details come together. But a question that is more fundamental, a question that our people in our country need to understand, is why will God allow such a thing to happen? You know, most people look around, they can't imagine that. You know, what we saw, of course, the tragedy that occurred on the 11th of September had a real ripple effect across the country, but it was something that was unexpected. It produced a lot of shock in so many people. But one of the things that made people fighting mad, if you really wanted to stir up a controversy and really get a fuss going, suggest that maybe we were being punished by God for our sins. You know, Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell sort of suggested that, and boy, did they get slapped down. I mean, they were attacked in the media. In fact, there were cartoons that linked the two of them up with, right along with Osama bin Laden, and they were sort of all lumped together. You know, that was terrible to suggest that. If you want to get people mad, suggest that maybe their lives aren't pleasing to God and there are going to be consequences. Well, they don't like that. Why would God allow things like this to happen to our country? Why will He allow the situation that right now is just beginning to develop, and we see certain aspects of it on the world scene? Why would God allow such things to come together and to impact the American, the Canadian, the British people? It's important that we understand that answer. I want us today to focus on two particular prophets in the Bible. We can look at a lot of them, but we're going to limit our attention today to two particular prophets who described not only the tragedy that is going to occur, they explained the reason why it will occur, and they also focused on the triumph that lies beyond the tragedy. There is a great deal that we can come to understand from their message that applies to our day and our time. Now, the first of the prophets that I have reference to is the prophet Amos. We're going to actually look at Amos and Micah today, two prophets that maybe we don't focus a lot of attention on. I want to look a little bit at the background or the setting, the circumstances in which Amos and Micah wrote. And then as we understand the setting and what was going on in their day, let's look at what they had to say, because the message that they wrote was written against the backdrop of what was going on in their day and in their time, what was occurring. But as we go through the message, we find that it has implications that go way beyond their day, because Amos and Micah both talked of a time that they call the Day of the Lord, a time of God's future intervention on the world scene, a time when God will step into history. Now let's notice here in Amos chapter 1 and verse 1, the words of Amos, who was among the herdsmen of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. Now, Tekoa is a city, small, not really a city, a little town, a village, that was about 12 miles south of Jerusalem. Amos lived in Judah. He was a Jew. He lived in the area south of Jerusalem. But he had a message that concerned Israel. So he was a prophet with a message to deliver to northern Israel, the northern kingdom. Remember, when Solomon died, the nation split into two different kingdoms. The northern kingdom, the 10 tribes, the house of Israel, and the southern kingdom, Judah. We're told the timing of Amos' prophecy. He prophesied during the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and Jeroboam. This is Jeroboam the second, not the original Jeroboam, but Jeroboam the second in Israel. Now, both of these kings had lengthy reigns, and they ruled in the first half of the 8th century, between about, their reigns did not totally overlap, but primarily they did. And we're basically looking at a period between about 790 and 740 from the time the first of these came on the scene till the last of them passed away, about a 50-year period that occurred here. Now, several things to understand as we look at the sort of the backdrop of what was going on We'll see in a few moments that Micah prophesied a little bit later than Amos, but in the same general time period, a little later in the same century. After the split between Israel and Judah after the death of Solomon, the nation went through a lot of difficulties, and it lost a lot of the power, the prosperity, the things that had been characteristic of the nation in an earlier time. But as we pick up the story in 2 Kings, we look here, I just get a little bit of the background, 2 Kings 14. 2 Kings 14, we read of, in the earlier part of the chapter, we read of warfare between Judah and Israel, and the king of Israel invaded Judah and actually hauled away a lot of treasure, as it mentions in verse 14, and returned back to Samaria. Well, this particular king, whose name was Joash, 2 Kings 14:16, he died, they buried him in Samaria, and his son, Jeroboam, reigned in his stead. And goes on, records a little bit of further things that happened. A man by the name of Azariah, also known as Uzziah, he had two different names, and he's in Kings and Chronicles he's referred to differently. He initially took the throne as the regent in the last years of his father's life because of this battle that his father had lost, and then he came to full power as king. Verse 22, he built Eilat and restored it to Judah. Now, that's just so, that's short, and we read that, and he built Eilat. Well, that's nice. We read over it and don't understand necessarily the implications. If you look at a map, you know what one of the major ports, seaports for the state of Israel is today? It's Eilat, right down there at the very northern tip of the Red Sea. Eilat was a strategic outpost. It was the location of where Solomon's eastern navy was based. If you look at the history of the ancient world, you realize that so much of the trade and the commerce that went on involved nations like India, Persia, and the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen, and on around into Ethiopia and Egypt. The sea lane that came down from the Red Sea and around the Arabian Gulf and into the Indian Ocean was the major and the richest source of trade and commerce at that time. Judah had been squeezed out of that since early on. Soon after the days of King Solomon, the Edomites had captured the port of Eilat, and Israel was, or Judah rather, was blocked off from the Red Sea and did not have access. So it put them out of that maritime commerce, and it had a effect on the economy. This lasted many decades. When Uzziah came to the throne, the major thing that he accomplished from a geopolitical and an economic standpoint was he restored a lot. He captured this area right at the top of the Red Sea, and he rebuilt the seaport, and this served as a naval base. And what we find is that there ensued for several decades the richest economically, the richest period in Judah's history after the death of Solomon. It was a time of prosperity, of trade, of commerce. All these things were going on and centered here around the port of Eilat. Now, if we come on, we find in verse 23 that Jeroboam came to the throne, and he reigned 41 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He was not a righteous man. Jeroboam was up in the northern kingdom, in northern Israel. While Uzziah restored Eilat restored maritime commerce here for Judah, what did Jeroboam do? Verse 25, he restored the coast of Israel, the northern kingdom, from the entering of Hamath into the sea of the plain, according to the word of the Lord God of Israel that he spoke by the hand of his servant Jonah. This is the same Jonah that wrote the book of Jonah. The Eternal saw the affliction of Israel, verse 26, that it was very bitter. There was not any shut up, nor any left, nor any helper for Israel. And the Lord said that he would not blot out the name of Israel from under heaven. He saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. And the other things that Jeroboam did, he was a great warrior. He expanded the kingdom north, even to occupying Damascus in Hamath. He expanded the nation of Israel. So what we find in the beginning of the 8th century B.C. is a time of prosperity. It was a time of political stability, because both of these kings had very lengthy reigns of several decades. So it was a period of political stability. It was a period of economic prosperity. It was a time of a booming economy of maritime commerce and trade. It was, on the surface, a good time. But there's more to the story. Let's come on a little further. Let's go to 2 Chronicles and let's look at a parallel account. Here in 2 Chronicles in chapter 26, all the people of Judah took Uzziah, who was 16, and they made him king. Verse 2, he built a lot. Again, as we saw back in 2 Kings, here 2 Chronicles mentions the same thing. And then it begins to tell a little bit about him. For a while, Uzziah did do what was right in God's sight, verse 4. Verse 6, he went forth and he warred against the Philistines, broke down the wall of Gath. Verse 7, God helped him against the Philistines and against the Arabians. Verse 8, the Ammonites gave gifts to him. He strengthened himself greatly. Verse 9, he built towers in Jerusalem at the corner gate and the valley gate and the turning of the wall. He fortified them. He built towers in the desert. He dug many wells. He had much cattle. He loved farming. And so he really built things up in that way. The nation prospered. He had a good economic policy in terms of not only trade and commerce, but also agriculture. He was a warrior. Verse 11, he had a host of fighting men that went out to war by bands. Tells the story of some of those men. In fact, verse 15, he made in Jerusalem engines invented by cunning men to be on the towers and upon the bulwarks to shoot arrows and great stones. This was the original missile race. Missile doesn't have to mean something that is powered by what we think of today. Missile just means a projectile, something that's shot. Well, he had missiles that he was shooting. They had technological advances, catapults and various things that some of his engineers invented and put on the walls of Jerusalem. And he was quite a formidable fellow. His name spread far abroad. He was marvelously helped till he was strong. That sounds great. Almost sounds a little bit like some of what we've seen in our land. There was a problem, though, verse 16 brings out. When he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction. He transgressed against the Eternal, his God. He went into the temple of the Lord to burn incense upon the altar of incense. Now, that was something that was reserved only to the priests. And when he came in, had evidently become so filled with pride, taking the credit. I think there's a very interesting statement at the end of verse 15. It says, for he was marvelously helped till he was strong. Now, if he had really grasped the implication of that statement, he wouldn't have been lifted up with pride. You see, you get lifted up with pride when you think, look what I did. What he should have looked at was what God had done. But instead of spending his time thanking God and being appreciative for what God had accomplished, he began to sort of look in the mirror and say, I'm really the greatest king this country's had in a long time. In fact, I may be the greatest king they've ever had. Look at all I've done. Look at what I've accomplished. Well, the more he thought about that, of course, what happened? His heart was lifted up in pride. And it was lifted up to his destruction. He went into the temple, as we mentioned, to burn incense. Now, there are a couple of different places in the Bible that refer to an earthquake in the days of Uzziah. And it was evidently a very formidable earthquake, because it was remembered over two centuries later. Certain major events are remembered that way. I remember years ago when we lived in Missouri, southern Missouri, Cape Girardeau, Missouri. Cape Girardeau is a little bit north of a little town called New Madrid, Missouri. Now, you may be aware of the fact, if you've ever read much about earthquakes and things like that, that one of the major earthquake fault lines in this country is the New Madrid Fault. And people around that area still talked about the New Madrid earthquake. Now, that had happened way back in the 1830s, but it was such a strong earthquake that the Mississippi River flowed backward for miles. And there was actually a new channel that was carved out. There's an area in Tennessee called the Real Foot Lake area, which is really where the original bend of the Mississippi was. And that's cut off as just a lake because the river flowed backward for so many miles, and when it came back with force, it carved out a straighter channel and it left that area isolated. We had one of our church members lived right on Real Foot Lake. And so it was fascinating to me as I heard the story, and you look around and you see all of that. Sometimes, but for an event to be remembered 150, 200 years later, it had to be on that magnitude. It had to be serious. That's considered to be, as far as we know, the most powerful earthquake that ever occurred in the United States that we have any record of. But it's mentioned back in Zechariah chapter 14, verse 5, talking about the return of Christ, and how in verse 4, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, and the Mount of Olives will cleave in the midst. In verse 5, it says, "And you will flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Azal." Yes, you will flee like you fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Now, that was the earthquake that all other earthquakes were measured by 200 years after it had happened. So, Amos dates his prophecy. He said, "This prophecy that I gave in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, king of Israel, it was given 2 years before the earthquake." Okay? Everybody knew that. The trouble is, the Bible doesn't tell us exactly when the earthquake occurred. But everybody back then, when they were, "Oh, 2 years before, oh yeah, the earthquake." You didn't have to even say which earthquake, just the earthquake. 200 years later, they said, "Well, it was the earthquake in the days of Uzziah." And it's compared with the one that's going to occur when Christ returns, so you get the idea that it's going to be pretty, it was a pretty formidable earthquake. As I say, we don't know exactly when that earthquake occurred from the Bible, but Josephus and Jewish tradition says that it occurred in the aftermath of Uzziah going into the temple to burn incense. The Bible tells us he was struck with leprosy. God took it pretty seriously when he took this upon himself. He was warned first. The high priest came in and said, "You better get out of here." Uzziah flared up and said, "Who do you think you are? You know, you can't tell me that. I'm the king." Okay, you don't want to take it from God's servants. You can get it from God himself. It's sort of like, on what level do you want correction? See, the smart thing for Uzziah to have done was said, "You know, you're right. Let me get out of here. And let me apologize on the way out. Let me apologize to God for that." But instead, he flared up with pride. So then the high priest didn't have to do anything. God stepped in. God smote him with leprosy, and the man lived for years in this terrible condition, and his son had to take over and actually run the kingdom. Well, I can't prove from the Bible that the earthquake occurred right in the aftermath of that, but that's what the Jewish historian Josephus says. And when you look at an earthquake of that significance, it had to occur sometime right in that time. It was the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, and I don't know of any other event in the days of Uzziah that would have prompted God to send quite an earthquake in that way. That's the most dramatic thing that happened in the days of Uzziah, so it certainly makes sense that that was the case. The point is that Amos was writing at a time when prosperity had not been interrupted. It was 2 years before the earthquake when Amos delivered his prophecy. I think probably that earthquake was the beginning of decline. You know, an earthquake can have devastating effect. We know what you have when you have an earthquake. I was in Los Angeles, here in Pasadena, back a little over 30 years ago when a major earthquake struck there and the damage that it did, and there have been other earthquakes since. An earthquake causes a lot of damage. And if you had one of that significance that people were talking about even a couple of centuries afterward, you'd say that it destroyed cities, it destroyed dwellings, it did a lot of serious economic damage. So Amos was delivering his message in the good times. God didn't have to wait till the problems had started and sort of project out present trends. God declares the end from the beginning. Now, as we go through here in Amos, Amos is from the southern kingdom, from Tekoa. He's a farmer. He's come now up to Israel. Remember, after Jeroboam set up his independent kingdom after Solomon's death, remember that he built two centers of worship, one way up in the north at Dan, one down in the southern part at Bethel. Amos showed up at Bethel. which was the king's chapel. That was the main center of religion in northern Israel. Amos shows up from Judah, and he begins to announce a message. He said, verse 2, "The Lord will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem." Well, now that wasn't a popular thing to say. You're saying God talks from the temple down there in Jerusalem. Well, you're up here at the one we've got in Bethel, and you're saying God's got something to say, and he's going to say it from Jerusalem. He's going to say it from the mercy seat, from between the cherubim and the Holy of Holies, there on Mount Zion, there in Jerusalem. That's where God talks from. Well, this didn't necessarily get Amos off to a real good start with the folks in Bethel, because as we're going to see a little later, he was confronting the king's high priest. But now Amos began to launch into the message, and you know, for a while, they sort of liked what Amos had to say. Amos said, "I want to talk about Damascus, the capital of Syria. Do you think God is going to let them get by with what they've done? They threshed Gilead with threshing instruments of iron." Now, Gilead was part of northern Israel. It was the eastern part, northeastern part. And the Syrians had come in and had really brutally ground down this part of Gilead that they captured. This expression, "they threshed it with threshing instruments of iron," is sort of a poetic description. Iron threshing instruments really crushed whatever they, a lot more effective than wood. And he said, they threshed Gilead. I mean, they came in and they cleaned house. You think God's going to let those Syrians get by with what they did in Gilead, the way they just ground everybody down? Well, folks in Bethel, there in northern Israel, they said, you know, that's a good point. You're right, you know. Maybe this guy isn't all bad, this fellow from Judah. God's going to get the Syrians. Okay, well, they like that. He said, now let me tell you something else. Verse 6, he says, you think God's going to let Gaza get by with what they've done, the Philistines? They carried away the whole captivity to deliver them up to Edom. They were merciless. They captured these people in border regions and sold them into slavery to the Edomites. You think God's going to let them get by with that? They'd captured, see, some Israelite cities and some cities of Judah, and they had sold them into captivity, sold them into slavery to the Edomites. He said, don't you think God's going to deal with these Philistines for that? Boy, yeah, that's right. He said, now what about Tyre, verse 9? They delivered up the whole captivity to Edom, and they didn't remember the brotherly covenant. You know, he said, Tyre had an agreement with you folks here in Israel. Tyre had entered into a covenant, a brotherly covenant, and they betrayed that. They were treacherous. They saw there was money to be made, and they sold your people. Don't you think God's going to deal with them for that? Boy, Amos really had the folks agreeing with him. You know, they thought, this Amos, he's not a bad preacher. You know, he's really getting after all these other folks. He said, now what about the Edomites? Verse 11. You know, the Edomites pursued, Edom pursued his brother with a sword and cast off all pity. His anger did tear perpetually. He kept his wrath forever. No pity these Edomites had. Don't you think God's going to deal with them for that? Yep. Well, they agreed with that too. He said, now what about the Ammonites? Verse 13. God's not going to turn away their punishment either. They ripped up women with child in Gilead that they might enlarge their border. They were a brutal people, absolutely brutal in the pursuit of wealth. They were coming in trying to expand their border, expand their empire. They came in and were just so brutal the way they treated people, even murdering pregnant women. Don't you think God's going to punish the Ammonites for that? Boy, yeah, absolutely. Ammonites deserve it too. What about the Moabites? Chapter 2, verse 1. You know, the Moabites burned the bones of the king of Edom into lime. They didn't do something to the Israelites, but they had fought a war with Edom. And the Moabites, to show their utter contempt, burned the body of the king of Edom, just burned him, burned his bones until they used it for fertilizer, to go out and fertilize the field. Absolute contempt. Think God doesn't take note of that? That absolute lack of respect for another person, God's going to deal with them. And furthermore, he said, Judah. Verse 4, Judah, back where I come from, God's not going to turn away the punishment from there either, because they have despised the law of the Lord and have not kept his commandments. Well, you know, about this time, Amos was probably a pretty popular fellow there. folks, he was gathering a pretty good crowd. They like to hear that. They like to hear all of their neighbors really raked over the coals for what they were doing wrong and to be told, you know, God's not going to put up with that. God's going to deal with those Ammonites and Moabites and Edomites and Philistines. He's going to deal with the people of Tyre, and he's going to deal with the Syrians and Damascus. In fact, he's even going to deal with the Jews. But you see, at this point, Amos, in their eyes, quit preaching and he went to meddling. Instead of just stopping with Judah, he said, now let me tell you something else. Now that we've seen what God's going to do to all the neighbors, let me tell you what he's going to do to you. Verse 6. For three transgressions of Israel and for four, I'm not going to turn away the punishment thereof. They have sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. They pant after the dust on the head of the poor and turn aside the way of the meek, and a man and his father go into the same maid to profane my holy name. He said, your nation, Israel, is absolutely characterized by greed, by selfish pursuit of materialism, by immorality. There are no barriers, no standards of what's right and wrong. They've sold the righteous for silver for a price. They'll do anything to anybody. You know, justice is for sale, he told the Israelites. He said, justice is for sale here. You'll sell the righteous for silver. You'll go through the outward trappings of legality to squeeze something more from the poor. He said there are going to be serious consequences. In fact, the time is coming when the mighty will not be able to deliver himself, verse 14, when your armies are going to flee. Chapter 3, he goes on into the indictment. He said, look, you have I known of all the peoples. You only have I known of all the peoples on the earth. God said to Israel, I have had a special relationship with you, one that is different than I've had with any other people. I called you and brought you out of Egypt. I brought you into this inheritance. I want you to realize a couple of things, verse 3. One, can two walk together lest they be agreed? You can't continue walking with me, or you can't have my company if you don't agree with me. We can't walk the same path unless there's agreement. Now, you know, God's not going to change his mind to agree with us. So if we're going to walk with God, we have to change our mind to agree with him. Then he went on to tell them, verse 7, he says, surely the Lord God will do nothing except he reveals his secrets unto his servants, the prophets. God's truth, God's purpose of what he's going to accomplish is going to be delivered as a message. He went on to describe in verse 9 the tumults in the midst of Samaria, which was the capital city of Israel. The tumults, great tumults in the midst thereof, the oppressed in the midst thereof. So he talked about strife. He said, you're going to have increasing civil strife, tumult, all sorts of problems. Well, God talked about visiting the transgressions of Israel. And then he's been really sort of tying into the men and the ones who were grinding down others in their pursuit of greedy materialistic advancement. Then he ties into the women in chapter 4, and he refers to them as the cows of Bashan. And Bashan was a rich agricultural area of Israel over on the east side of the Jordan River. And he describes them as oppressing the poor and crushing the needy, which say to their masters, bring and let us drink. So he indicted the women. He said, you know, you've been pushing your husbands to provide more luxuries, and you haven't been concerned about the poor, and you just sort of egged them on to do worse than what they were already doing because you're selfish and self-centered. God has sworn by his holiness, verse 2, that the days are going to come upon you that he will take you away with hooks and your posterity with fish hooks. You know, for years, centuries, people read that and didn't really know what was being talked about. But several decades ago, archaeologists discovered some things, Assyrian monuments, and they saw carved, actually, pictures of the Assyrians hauling their captives away. The Assyrians, with good German efficiency, didn't want to have to waste a lot of soldiers guarding these caravans of captives. And you know what they did? They literally, it's depicted right there on the monuments. They put a literal hook, just like a fish hook, in their lower lip. attached it by a chain to the guy in front of them, and he had a, and so you had these whole long lines of people that had the, like a fish hook in their lower lip attached by a chain to the guy in front. Now, you know what your incentive is on that? You're going to walk a straight line. You're sure not going to try to duck all through the brush, you know, about the time you get to an area. No escape plans there. You've got a fish hook through your lip that's right there. You try to move, you get out of line, you don't want any, you want to maintain just the right distance with the guy in front of you. You don't want any pressure. Very brutal way of doing things, and the Assyrians were proud of what they had done. They'd come up with a very efficient way of brutally transporting thousands of people, and they had them hooked up like that. Amos prophesied of it. Now, what's interesting is that Assyria had not emerged on the world scene until actually about probably 15, 20 years after Amos was writing this. He was writing it 2 years before the earthquake. And that would be approximately, the dates can vary maybe a year or so, but approximately that would be about 757 B.C. Assyria did not begin to really emerge as a power at this point in history until about 743, when Tiglath-Pileser came to the throne in Assyria and began to sort of stir things up, and Assyria began a militant policy reaching out toward the other nations around. But you get off into other things. But Assyria had not yet emerged. They hadn't done any of this. But Amos foresaw what was going to happen. He went on, and he talked about how, in verse 4, he talks about coming to Bethel. They had the form of religion. At this peak of prosperity, still 2 years before the earthquake, Amos told them, verse 6, God says, I'm going to give you cleanness of teeth in all your cities. He's not talking about dental hygiene. He's talking about people who don't have anything to eat. He's talking about people starving. There'll be want of bread. You haven't returned unto me for all of that. Withhold the rain. In fact, as he describes here in verse 7, it'll rain on one city and not on another. In fact, you'll wind up with a water crisis, and people from two or three cities will go to another city that they think has water. Describes a water crisis. In fact, we're not very far from some of that in the West right now. You know, we look around in soggy East Texas right now, and we don't think that really applies to us. But if you come on down, God says in verse 9, I've smitten you with blasting and mildew. Blasting had to do with these hot, dry winds that came in and just dried everything out. You know, no rain, these hot, dry winds just shrivel up the crops. Well, that's bad. But that's not the only thing that can be bad. What if you get too much rain? What if everything gets mildewed? We're not, you know, real long way from some of that in what we've been experiencing. You know, not there yet, but realize that different things could happen, blasting and mildew. He talks about young men being slain with a sword. Warfare. Yet, you've not returned to the Lord. You've not returned to the Lord. And this statement is echoed here over and over up in verse 6 and down in verse 8 and down in verse 9 and down in verse 10 and down in verse 11. You've not returned to the Lord. This happened. You've not returned to the Lord. So what? Verse 12. Prepare to meet your God. O Israel, given you opportunities to change and to repent, now you better prepare to meet your God, because you're going to have to reckon. Chapter 5 goes on and describes the virgin of Israel is fallen. How the city that went out, verse 3, by 1,000 will leave 100. Thus says the Lord, verse 4, unto the house of Israel, seek me and you will live. Seek me and you will live. Verse 6, seek the Lord and you will live. Understand the mighty God, His power and His greatness. Verse 14, seek good and not evil that you may live. Verse 15, hate the evil and love the good. That's what God wants. You see, people had a form of religion. And when they thought of the day of the Lord, they thought in terms of God's vindication of Israel. Oh, they said, that'll be fine. When God steps in, boy, He'll straighten out all the enemies and all the neighbors. Well, Amos said to him, verse 18 of chapter 5, woe unto you that desire the day of the Lord. To what end is it for you you're going to find when the day of the Lord comes, the day that God steps in, you're going to be in worse trouble than you already are. Don't think that you can count on the fact, well, we're God's people, and so nothing bad will happen to us. God will come back and punish everybody else. Amos told the people of Israel, he said, God's going to deal with you. No. In verse 22, he says, though you offer me burnt offerings and your food offerings, I will not accept them, neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat animals. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I won't listen to the melody of your musical instruments. I'm not interested in all of these things that you're doing, all of the trappings of religion. What I want to see, verse 24, let judgment run down as waters and righteousness as a mighty stream. I want to see right be done. I want to see people change the way they live. I want to see them change the way they deal with one another. I want to see those in positions of power and authority to be motivated by something other than greed. I want to see compassion and fairness. I want to see what's equitable and what's just. I want a stream to begin running, not a stream of water, but a stream of righteousness. And other streams feed into it, and it becomes a mighty river. It becomes a rushing, roaring river that comes down like standing by Niagara Falls or something. Let judgment run down as waters, and righteousness as a mighty stream. I want to see people changing their lives. I want to see it funneling in just like little streams into a river that becomes greater and larger and more powerful and more onrushing. Not just the form. Don't think you can just sort of come and play some music and say some nice things and bring a little offering and go away and live your life the way you're living it. Taking advantage of people, cheating people, oppressing people, taking advantage of power to crush others down. Chapter 6, verse 1, woe to them that are at ease in Zion and trust in the mountain of Samaria. Their confidence is in their military might and their great power status. They're named the chief of the nations. Boy, they're at the pinnacle. They're at the top. They trust in that. Verse 4, lie upon beds of ivory and stretch themselves out on their couches and eat, you know, the fat of the land, as it were. They eat the lambs out of the flock and the calves out of the midst of the stall. They've got plenty to eat, all the luxury items. They spend their time with music, chanting to the sound of the viol. They invent for themselves instruments of music like David. They drink wine by the bowl full. Not the glass full, the bowl full. They anoint themselves with the chiefest ointments, but they're not grieved for the affliction of Joseph. Oh, they can spend their time in the pursuit of luxury. They've got every luxury that can be imaginable. They are self-indulgent. They spend their time with music and actually not just alcohol, but the abuse of alcohol when you're drinking it by the bowlful. They are sparing no expense, anointing themselves with the cheapest ointments, the most expensive things. They are indulged in the pursuit of luxury, but they're not grieved for the affliction of Joseph. It doesn't bother them what's really happening. They're going to go captive with the first that go captive, Amos said. He told them that the nation was going to be raised up against them in verse 14. Went on to describe what God is going to do. He describes God in chapter 7 and verse 7 as standing by a wall made by a plumb line. And God holds a plumb line in His hand. And He told Amos, He said, you know what I'm doing? What do you see, Amos? And Amos said, well, I see a plumb line. And the Lord said, I'm going to set a plumb line to the midst of my people Israel. And I'll not again pass by them anymore. I'm going to measure things. You know what a plumb line was for in ancient times when you, in the building trades, plumb line played a major role. That was the way you ensured that what you were building was straight. You know, you attached it and the weight held it down. And that was the primary means by which you ensure. You know, you can't just go out and build a wall. You can't just build it sort of based on the way it looks. Well, I think that's looking pretty straight. You build a wall very high and you may find you got quite a slant to it. Sort of looks straight as you were putting it up, but then it gets up high and say, that's got a slant. In fact, that may fall. No, they used a plumb line. God, in effect, used the description. He said, look, I'm setting a plumb line. I'm going to measure you. Because it looked like to me we got a wall that is tottering and about to fall. the problems that Israel had were not problems of lack of money. They weren't lack of material things. God had blessed them in material ways. But you see, the real riches of a nation lies in its moral and spiritual values. The real riches of a nation is in the family, in the morality with which people deal with one another, the way that people treat one another. You know, you ever think about the fact as to the fact that several of the Ten Commandments deal with economics, have very strong economic implications. The commandment says you shall not steal. Clearly economic, that has to do with property, respect of private property, not trying to steal from people, take advantage, whether it's their property or their wages. It also said you don't covet. So you're not trying to figure a way to beat somebody out of what's theirs, or to cheat them. It says you don't lie. Don't bear false witness, so you don't misrepresent things. What you say is the way it is. You don't make promises that aren't true. Can you imagine the economic implications if just those three commandments were kept? Just imagine that everybody in the country had to keep those three commandments. Even if they didn't have to keep the other seven, if they just kept those three, what would be the economic ripple effect? What would be the effect on Madison Avenue in the advertising industry? What would be the effect on some of these corporate mergers and buyouts and bailouts? Could you have had something like Enron that took place? You know, everybody didn't lose money on it. There were folks that managed to come out pretty good right before the whole thing went belly up. There usually are. You know, they talk about wars devastating an economy and wrecking things. Well, you know, there are always people who make fortunes out of wars. In fact, that's where most of the great fortunes have come from, is from war. People on the winning side of it. And of course, a lot of times, historically, people have played both sides on the against the middle. You go back to the Napoleonic Wars, and that was, of course, the world war of the beginning of the 19th century, dragged on for a period of years. The Rothschild family had banking, controlled the banking industry in several areas. They had a bank in Germany, and they had one in Italy, and they had one in France, and they had one in Austria, and they had one in England. And so that pretty well covered the major areas. The father of the family had five sons, so he set each of them up in one of the major cities of Europe. Well, when the time came, they didn't have, at that point, they didn't have telegraph, they didn't have cell phones, but they had carrier pigeons. And part of the fortune of the family was made at the time of the Battle of Waterloo, because the first report to cross the English Channel, the first person in England that got the news of how the battle had gone, because the government didn't think of doing anything quicker than putting a dispatch on boat and sending it across the water. But what they did was send a carrier pigeon across. So what happened was they spread the rumor. You know, it's amazing. All you got to do is just sort of whisper a couple of things. And the rumor spread throughout London, and it panicked the city of London, and stock prices plummeted because the rumor went out that the British had lost and Napoleon was coming. Well, that panicked everybody in the financial center of London. Of course, if stock prices plummet, that's a wonderful time to buy stock if you know they're going to go back up. And guess what, you know? By the next day, when the official news had arrived, people found out that the rumor that they had sold on was really not true. But you know, it's hard to track back a rumor and to figure out where it started. All you got to do is just sort of let a hint go out to a few people, and they spread it. And nobody gets to really trace it back. And it really established their fortune in a very, very formidable way. Now, if it had gone the other way, you see, they were set up in France, they were set up in England. It's interesting, you look into our history and you realize that there were corporations that were set up in Nazi Germany and in the United States, and you look into some of the great financial families and some of their oil trading during World War II, and they were covered whichever way it went. They weren't the ones who were going to come out losing. They never are. Over and over. It's not just unique to our time and our day. You see, it's characteristic of human greed. Of human greed. God says, I'm going to raise up against you a nation. I'm going to put a plumb line to the nation. We're going to see how straight things are measured. In fact, he said, the high places are going to be desolate, verse 9. The sanctuary is laid waste, and I'm going to rise up against the house of Jeroboam with the sword. Now, about this time, Amos had said too much as far as Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, was concerned. He sent word to Jeroboam, and he said, look, we got to do something about old Amos. You know, he's stirring up trouble. He's conspiring against you. The land is not able to bear his words. Amaziah told Amos, verse 12, he said, I think it's about time for you to go back where you came from. I think you better get out of here. Go back down to Judah and eat your bread there and prophesy there. You tell them, that's where you're from, go back down there. We don't need you up here. This is the king's chapel. This is the king's court. And Amos said, let me tell you something. I'm not in this for the money. I'm not a professional prophet. I'm a farmer. I'm up here because God told me to be up here. I was minding my own business, and God said, go prophesy to Israel. I want to tell you something. You don't think these things that I'm saying are going to happen. Well, they are, and before it's all over with, your wife is going to be a harlot in the city. And you and your children are going to be dead. And the nation is going to go into captivity. Now, if Amos was popular before, he was really popular about that time. You know, God picked a man that was not inclined to back down. When he told him, get out of here, Amos didn't salute and say, yes, sir, I'm getting out just as quick as I can. Amos gave him God's message. God told Amos, chapter 8 and verse 2, the end has come upon my people Israel. I'm not going to pass by again. He went on to talk about verse 4, hear this, O you that swallow up the needy, to make the poor of the land to fail, anxious to do business, falsifying, making the ephah small and the shekel great. That means you're selling less and less for more and more. Just another way of describing inflation, isn't it? Selling, making the ephah small, you know, selling less and less. That was the unit of measurement. The shekel great, needing more shekels for less stuff. Falsifying the balances by deceit, buying the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, selling the refuse of the wheat, cheating people, taking advantage of someone, grinding down those that are least able to defend themselves. You know, that's where you go after if you have the mentality of a bully. You go after the people who are least able to defend themselves. What can they do? Shall not the land tremble for all this? God says in verse 8. No, the time's coming, verse 11. Amos says, you want me to get out of here? You don't want me to prophesy in Bethel anymore? Let me tell you something. You know what God says? There's going to be a famine in the land, but not just a famine of food or water, but a famine of the word of the Lord, of hearing the words of God. There's going to be a famine of the word, because the time is coming when these things are going to happen, and your whole world is going to be crashing in around you, and then you're going to wish you could talk to one of God's true servants and find out what it all means and where it's all going. No, God describes what is going to happen and what he was going to do. Now, let's go back to Micah very briefly. We're not going to have a lot of time for Micah. Micah, chapter 1, verse 1, was prophesying in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, what he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. That mentions kings of Judah, Jotham, taking over from his father Uzziah about 750. So Micah came on the scene and began his prophetic career after the earthquake, after the transition from Uzziah to Jotham. And he says, verse 3, the Lord comes forth out of his place and will come down and tread upon the high places of the earth. He talks about the sins of the house of Israel, verse 5. Chapter 2, verse 1, woe to them that devise iniquity, that work evil upon their beds. When the morning is light, they practice it. Verse 2, they covet fields and take them by violence, and houses and take them away. They oppress a man in his house, even a man in his heritage. Now it says they go to sleep dreaming up schemes to cheat people. Can't wait to get up in the morning and put it into practice. And its base is motivated by covetousness. They're greedy. They want what somebody else has. They're already wealthy. They've already got plenty, but they want to squeeze the last little bit out of anybody else. And they oppress a man in his house, trying to squeeze out the small farmer or the small tradesman. Try to squeeze him out and just take over. Well, he goes on and he talks about the false prophets. He describes describes in chapter 3 these individuals as eating the flesh of my people. Verse 3 compares them to vultures, just sort of picking away until there's nothing but the bones. Verse 10, they build up Zion with blood and Jerusalem with iniquity. The heads thereof judge for reward, the priests teach for hire, and the prophets divine for money. They're in it for what they can get. Justice is for sale. The leaders, they have a price. Those who are supposed to be the leaders of religion, the priests, they teach for hire. They you know, you pay, they preach. They're willing to change their doctrines up just for the money. Dr. Torrance made reference to some of that in the sermonette. It's been around for a long time. People who were for sale. They were for sale. You know, the only reason somebody's for sale is because they're greedy. And that's what we have right here. What they could see was more real to them than God. Well, he goes on and he describes in chapter 6, verse 2, the Lord has a controversy with his people and he'll plead with Israel. What is it that God wants? Chapter 6, verse 7, is he going to be pleased with thousands of rams or 10,000s of rivers of oil? Can you buy God off? No. Verse 8, he showed you, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. That's what God is after. He's after a change of life, not simply a matter of going through outward form of religion. Religion is not something you put on and off like a garment, put it on for an hour or two a week and impress other people and then go hang it up, and certainly don't let it interfere with the rest of your life. No, God's indictment of the people was first and foremost because of the way they treated others, of greed and corruption. There was a moral and spiritual decay at the heart and core of the nation, a moral and spiritual decay. And it reflected itself in the family, and it reflected itself in many other ways. As you come on down, it talks about how in verse 16, the statutes of Omri are kept, the works of the house of Ahab. Laying aside the law that God gave through Moses, here they were taking the pagan statutes of Omri, one of the predecessor kings of Israel. Chapter 7, verse 2 says, the good man is perished. Verse 3, that they may do evil with both hands earnestly. The prince asks, the judge asks for a reward. The great man, he utters his mischievous desire, so they wrap it up. The best of them is as a briar. You know, just sharp as they can be. And they're sharper than a thorn hedge. That's what God describes. And he says, you know, it's a time of treachery and betrayal. Don't trust in a friend. Don't put confidence in a guide. A son, verse 6, dishonors the father, and the daughter rises against the mother. A man's enemies are those of his own household. It's a time of treachery and betrayal because people are for sale. Money, materialism, is the guiding force. You have a corruption in personal relationships, the family, every aspect of it. A society that is rotting and decaying from within. Verse 7, therefore I will look unto the Lord. I'll wait for my God. The God is going to bring forth the light and we'll behold His righteousness. You see, God indicts the nation, and when He indicts ancient Israel and Judah in the height of their prosperity and their abundance, it's no surprise that we read that and we find that it is very descriptive of our nation and our society today. And the same consequences are going to come. God's punishment is going to come. God describes that. But God is also a God, as He says in Micah 7 and verse 18, that pardons iniquity and passes by the transgression of the remnant of His heritage. He retains not His anger forever because He delights in mercy. He will turn again. He'll have compassion. He will subdue our iniquities and He'll cast all of their sins into the depths of the sea. God is going to allow these things to come to pass to bring our people to repentance. God much prefers mercy to wrath. And the time is coming when He'll pardon our iniquities. That time will be when our people have come to repentance. And He'll cast sin as far away as the depths of the sea. Micah describes in Micah 4, verse 1, in the last days. You see, Micah's prophecies went on beyond his day. He wasn't just talking about Israel and Judah of that day. In the last days, it'll come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established in the top of the mountains. It'll be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. And many nations shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He'll teach us of His ways, and we'll walk in His paths. For the law will go forth out of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge among many people. He will rebuke strong nations afar off. They will beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. They'll sit every man under his own vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. Well, it'll be a time of security, a time of peace, a time when you won't have to worry about somebody cheating you out of your vine and your fig tree. You won't have to worry about some terrorist coming in and burning down your vine and your fig tree or tearing it up. Nobody will make them afraid. It won't be a time when people will have to be heavily armed and all the security alarms and systems that are extant today. They won't learn war anymore. Nation will not lift up sword against nation. Swords will be beaten into plowshares because the law will go forth out of Zion. You can't restore peace without first restoring righteousness. The world will never have peace until it has righteousness. God's law will go forth. Micah looked down beyond his day, the difficulties, the strife, the trouble, and talked about in the last days, what God was going to do. You see, in chapter 5, he went on to say in verse 2, you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth unto me that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting. Now, even the priests of Jesus' day of the first century understood the implications of this verse. When King Herod called in the religious leaders and demanded of them where the Messiah was to be born, they quoted him Micah 5 and verse 2. They said, he'll come from Bethlehem. Now, they understood where the Messiah came from, but what they really didn't understand was the implications of the latter part of this verse. You see, the origin of the Messiah was born in Bethlehem, but that wasn't where everything started, because the goings forth of the Messiah have been from of old, from everlasting. John explained that more fully in John chapter 1. He says, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. You see, His goings forth have been from everlasting. That was the one who was going to restore the government of God. God's name will be great to the ends of the earth, as he talks about here in verse 4, and how God will gather His people. But right now, prior to that, God has a controversy with His people, as He says in Micah chapter 6 and verse 2. He has a controversy, and He will plead with Israel. That's a part of what's going on right now, and that's a part of what God's work is doing, as we take God's word and God's warning message to the nation. And you know what? The time is going to come before it's all over with that there will be a famine of the word. You know, right now people don't want to hear it. Time's going to come when they're going to wish they could. Let's close up here in Amos. Go back to Amos, to the very end of Amos. See, Amos also looked down beyond his days. The nation of Israel was going to go into captivity. A sinful kingdom, chapter 9 and verse 8, will be destroyed from off the face of the earth. But I will not utterly destroy it, God says. Verse 9, I'll sift the house of Israel among all the nations like corn to a sieve. Yes, Israel of Amos' day went into captivity because they wouldn't listen. They were sifted among the nations, but God didn't lose any of them. And in the last days, they emerged once again at the place where God had in mind. There is a time coming, in verse 11, when Amos prophesied that God will raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen. It'll be built up. We're told in verse 13, a time when the plowman will overtake the reaper, a time when the harvest will be so great, not a time of famine, of want of food, but a time when the harvest will be so great that it'll take them so long to get it out of the field, the plowman will be lining up to come right in behind because they're it's getting time to plant a new crop. The harvest was so great that it took extra long to get it out. I'm going to bring again the captivity of my people, Israel, verse 14, and they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them. The areas that have been destroyed and burned out and bombed out in the catastrophe and chaos that is to come. They'll plant vineyards and drink the wine. They'll make gardens and eat the fruit. And I will plant them upon their land, and they shall no more be pulled up out of the land that I've given them, says the Eternal of Hosts. There is that time of prosperity and abundance that's coming, but it will be a prosperity and abundance that's not based on a greedy, materialistic, selfish, self-centered attitude, an attitude that corrupts and decays, an attitude that has eaten the very heart out of our nations, a very self-centered approach that has begotten treachery and betrayal and legal corruption from one end to the other. But it'll be a prosperity and a peace that will be based on God's law, on God's truth. It will be a time of rebuilding. It'll be a time when God's way will go forth to all the world. The events that we're seeing right now on the world scene are the prelude to the things that Amos and Micah describe.